is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you come to expect, we Zoom the afternoon before, so if anything should happen between Monday night and Tuesday, it will not be reported on our show. We begin every show, and we have for months now, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman as he testified before the impeachment hearings of 2019. Now, here, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
We're back. I reached out to my good friend John Nichols of The Nation magazine a couple of days ago, and I said, John, come on the air. Let's talk about an article. I think it was about the defense budget and how we can sort of reprioritize the money and do whatever. And it was only a couple of days ago, John, and the world has changed in a couple of days. And in part,
it really has.
It has, because of the death of George Floyd, which in so many ways, I feel like there has been this undercurrent of agony and depression and fear and anxiety. And this sort of just exploded in part because obviously we would have reacted to the horrific things that we saw in that video that was happening to him as a result of police brutality. But at the same time, I feel like it was almost, we were ready to explode. And it has taken over us emotionally on so many different levels. So I'm grateful that you're here. I need to hear your voice. And it's also totally appropriate that even since you wrote this article, Keith Ellison on police brutality, quote, we need a vision that says there's going to be accountability, close quote. Even since you wrote that article, things have changed for Keith Ellison, because at the time that you wrote it, you were not aware that he would actually be prosecuting these police. So
that is true.
It's just to give people a sense of how things, the earth is shifting around us. And one other thing, John, I mentioned to my audience that, so my best friend died, and I just found out about an hour before the show. So I am grieving on multiple levels. And then I saw an article about Christo, that phenomenal, phenomenal public artist, had died at age 84. And I just want to sort of share something really quickly with you. I went to see his exhibit at Central Park called The Gates. And I went, it was created in 2005, and I went with Marty. He was still alive at the time. And I wrote this. I said, it was one of the most magical moments of my life. Christo was beyond a genius. He knew how to capture the spirit and imagination of mankind. And just for those of you who don't know, he made these huge, massive public artworks. And what was the most important thing about it, John, was that the term public, you didn't need a ticket to get in. You didn't need to be rich. You didn't need to be sophisticated. You just needed to be there. And I am just telling you that The Gates was probably one of the most amazing things, because people came from all walks of life. It was like a sense of Velcro and community I have never experienced before. And I have not experienced really ever since. And I think as we're looking at what's happening with George Floyd, and we're looking at the pandemic, and we're looking at a president who has no moral compass, I needed to understand that there are times when you can find ways to hold us together. And the loss of Christo reminded me that through his art, he managed to do it. So we can find it. Now the question is, can we find the leader that will help us to accomplish it? But with that, talk to me a little bit about your article and about your interview with Keith Ellison. I have been following Keith for a long time. I lived in Minnesota for a long time. I call the Twin Cities my other home. So this touches me on a lot of levels.
Well, I think it touches people across the country on a lot of levels. That's the interesting thing about this. And, you know, first off, condolences as regard to your friend. I was very sad to hear that. You know, loss is an interesting thing. There are losses which are very personal because we know someone.
Right.
There are also losses that become personal even though we didn't know the person, but we know the issue, we know the crisis, we know the concerns that are in play. And that's certainly been the truth with killing of George Floyd, an unarmed African-American man, the latest on a list of unarmed African-American men who have been killed by police officers while in custody. And in this case, there has been obviously an intense response in Minneapolis and across the country. And that response comes in a time of so many other traumas and challenges, coronavirus, mass unemployment, everything you mentioned as regards President Trump. So as this was all churning, I was very interested in speaking with Keith Ellison, the Attorney General of Minnesota, because though at that time he was not in charge of the prosecution of the officers involved in the death of George Floyd, he is the chief law enforcement officer of Minnesota. And beyond that, he is someone who, for a very, very long time, has had a deeply well thought out perspective on issues of economic and social and racial justice in general. He's a former co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and on police brutality in particular. So I wanted to hear what he had to say. And luckily for me, he was interested in talking. And so we had a series of conversations on Friday and Saturday about these issues. And it was an interesting dynamic because even as we were talking about it all, he would say sometimes, oh, I've got to take a break. I got to take a few minutes because I'm getting a call from George Floyd's family, or I'm getting a call from these city council members or other people. And it was clear that though he was not the prosecutor in charge at that time, he was very much central to it all. And he spoke of it very poignantly, very powerfully, as an African-American man, as a law enforcement figure, the Attorney General of the state, and also somebody who's deeply involved with policy. Now, as you know, over time, it was announced not long after we spoke that he would be taking over the prosecution of the officer who's been charged, and also aspects of the investigation going forward. So Ellison becomes even more central to this. And that makes the interview all the more interesting because this is a guy who really understands the issues that arise from police brutality, the connection to, you know, long-term racial injustice in this country, going back to slavery and segregation and everything that extended from that, and who also understands the vital importance of reforming our policing systems and our prosecutions. So we have a unique situation here, one of the first situations where you have a nationally followed, very high profile, police-involved killing of an African-American man, or allegations of, in this case, murder in the third degree. And it's being prosecuted by somebody who knows the territory, who understands it in a very deep and fundamental way. So it was a fascinating conversation, and our ongoing conversations remain fascinating.
And you talk about the fact that so he's very grounded in these issues. His time in Congress sort of helped to reinforce it. What I thought was absolutely fascinating is that there was a joint working group between the Minnesota Attorney General's Office and the Minnesota Commission of Public Safety that finished up in February of 2020. Talk about these issues being front and center in his mind, in what he's looking at, in the areas in which he wants to focus. So to a large extent, of all the people on the planet, he seems the one to be prepared as anyone can be to both lead this prosecution and also speak eloquently to a public that goes far beyond Minnesota.
That's very true. And it obviously is his intent to do that. Look, I've known Keith Ellison for a very, very long time and covered him in many settings. He is a very thoughtful, very engaged figure who knows his history, knows the Constitution very well, knows the law very well. He's practiced law for a very, very long time. And I know that he will be a fair and responsible prosecutor. With that said, I also know that he will come to this prosecution with a deeper understanding of what it means and what has to be done to get accountability than perhaps many other prosecutors who have handled it over time. That does not guarantee that this will be an easy prosecution. I don't think it will be, and I don't think he would ever suggest it would be. Nor does it guarantee that it will be resolved in the way that I think many people would hope it would be. But what is important is that I think Keith Ellison will talk us through this. And that's a big deal for America. Yeah.
Yes. I think his appointment, which was asked by the family, which was encouraged by mm-hmm. members of the city council, given his history, given the fact that they just had this commission resolved, given his knowledge and the depth of knowledge and his ability to speak to a larger audience, everyone understands that this is not a story of a Minnesota cop and a Minnesota resident of the time. This is much, much bigger than that. And therefore, the pressure and the responsibility is also bigger than that. And the ability for him to be able to walk us through and to be trusted. The most operative word here is that people are yearning for trust, John. That's, I think, mm-hmm. I think that's what has been so obvious to me, is that the African-American community does not trust the police. That the people that are there to make them safe, the people that are there to ensure security, are not trusted by the people that need to be made safe. And it was just made so evident in what happened to George Floyd. And he's not a one-off. That's the horror of this, is that there's such an incredible pattern and practice. And yet when do we acknowledge it? And when do we begin to address it?
Well, that's the big deal here. And it's interesting for people who read the interview, which is up at the Nation site. It's fascinating because Keith Ellison, the Attorney General up there, when we were speaking, started talking through all these cases that have come before, name by name by name, names we know, Michael Brown and others, names that some people may not know, but that certainly people who have been involved with these issues do. And you understand that here's somebody who has been watching this closely and has a deep sense of the frustration. And this is the significant thing. He knows the cases where police officers have been held to account. He is aware of those cases and he can highlight them. By the same token, he also knows the many, 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 many cases where charges were not brought, where convictions were not achieved, where you had hung juries and messed up trials and, you know, there's so many indications that holding these officers to account is either not a priority of prosecutors or juries or others, and also just something that has not over time come together. And it isn't, you know, we say that it's important to say the names of the people who have died, and it truly is. Over time, however, there becomes a pattern, right? We know the names, but we don't see the accountability. Right. And so what becomes glaring is that when there is evidence that seems to be quite overwhelming of police brutality, of police wrongdoing, of failures and crises in policing, there is not a resolution. And I think that for Ellison, there is a desire to break that pattern, to get to a point of resolution, not to be unfair to anyone, not to, you know, demand accountability where there is no need for accountability, but rather to demand accountability where there is a need and that need has been unmet for so long. So position to be in.
Right. I'm going to toss to Ken, but just one quick second, John, because he quotes Milton Friedman, He says, not a person I'm a fan of, he says. But he says, only in times of crises can true reform ever move forward. And I think everyone keeps saying, this feels different. This feels different. And yes, we can name the names, but for whatever, because we are at a crisis on steroids. You know, this happened at the most fragile, eruptive, unstable moment. And it was 8 minutes and 40 seconds of video. It's like all of this came together. And in some ways, it is a crisis because it feels so synergistic that you look at all these crises together and it is, and in a way, it has exploded. And it is an opportunity now that is both an opportunity and a responsibility. And what happens to George Floyd really could change everything.
No, you're right. It's a challenge, actually. And it's a challenge for Keith Ellison. It's a challenge for all of us. And it isn't just a challenge as regards the specific prosecution. And that's an important thing to understand. It is a challenge as regards policing and how we think of reforming and changing policing in these times. And there is an opening here, a possibility that real change could occur. But it was very interesting in our conversation that the Attorney General was very quick to point out that opening is no guarantee, that we have had openings before and we have not gotten to a resolution. And so there are a lot of demands on us. Now, you referenced something else that's really interesting here, and that is the tension of the moment, the broader tension of the moment. And you can't put everything into a long interview. And so one of the parts of our discussion that I didn't include was a discussion about coronavirus. And we were just talking about, again, I've known the Attorney General for a long time. And so we were speaking, at the start of our conversation, just about the moment we're in. And he said an interesting thing there, that the pandemic and the fact that we've all been locked down for a very long period of time has created a circumstance where we are on edge, where we are, more deeply concerned about the future and about our circumstance as individuals and as a society. We're facing mass unemployment, which is a huge issue. And he said that we should understand that these things intersect, right? That we have learned that coronavirus is an especially traumatic situation for the African-American community. We know that historically mass unemployment has affected African-American communities more than white communities. We know that police brutality has historically affected African-American communities more than white communities. So here we have an intersection of a health crisis, a employment crisis, now a reminder of a police brutality crisis. And is it any wonder that people are, at once overwhelmed, frustrated, sad, furious, but really in need of some evidence that the system works, that society works, and quite willing to demand that.
We have the capacity to address it, John, that we have the capacity to address it. I think that's part of it, too, is that in a lot of ways we're looking for leadership. We're looking for someone who can offer us hope. We're looking for someone who can give us the GPS, the road to follow. And I think in a lot of ways, that's why the family said, make Keith Ellison the prosecutor. I know, Ken, you want to weigh in, and I want to let you weigh in. But I as I'm thinking about this, there's a lot of politics also at play here. And Keith plays so many roles, but there's a political role he's playing as well at a time when we need leaders that we can trust. And I think what you heard from the family and what you heard from the city councilors is put Keith in charge, because he isn't just a prosecutor. He is an elected leader. And we need to have that connection between trust and leadership. Ken, you wanted to weigh in.
Well, yeah. And Keith also has credibility with the African-American community, trusts him. And also the white and the entire community realizes, he's not some wild man. He's a trusted, reasonable person. But I really like your point, John, about this problem and other racially motivated problems for years and years, but people need to be held accountable. And sometimes it doesn't happen, but it did happen. You know, the 64 Civil Rights Act was passed in the wake of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney's bodies being found after their murder in Mississippi during Freedom Summer. And there are times when accountability can happen. And here you have a leader and a turning point, and thing matters so much. I don't know how many people remember. I was just listening to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech a couple of months ago, and I was stunned to hear that he talks about police brutality. It's on his list. Dreadful things that happened. And yes, the Civil Rights Act passed involving employment and other things, but it didn't address police brutality. And you know, back in 1963, the speech everybody loves to quote, I Have a Dream, we still have a problem with police brutality in this country.
What did Keith say about accountability? What did Keith say about accountability? What does he want to accomplish other than prosecuting George Floyd? Because this isn't about prosecution. It's about so much more than that.
Yeah, it really is. And that's an important part. Our discussion was, remember, as you pointed out, and it's very important to note, our discussion came before he was appointed or chosen to take over the prosecution because of the frustrations with the district attorney or the prosecuting attorney in the Minneapolis area. So our discussion was, as I wanted it to be, about the kind of broader question of how we deal with these issues. And essentially what Keith goes to is this deeper place, or what Attorney General Ellison goes to, is this deeper place of understanding. And that is that we have a long-term challenge as regards policing in this country. Police officers too often are disconnected from the communities that they are supposed to serve. And instead of serving, you know, often have a warrior mentality, or are seen as having a warrior mentality. And this is, again, paraphrasing what Keith said. And what he suggested is that there really is a need to move toward a guardian mentality, a sense that you have a deep responsibility to genuinely protect and serve all people, not just one community or power. And the Attorney General says, in this regard, that you need to begin with policing. There's a lot of people say, oh, you have to fix society, and then policing will get fixed as part of that. No, what he suggests is begin with policing, because here you are talking about people who have a power of life and death, right, over individuals, and yet often act without sufficient accountability, without sufficient checks and balances. So he's very blunt in saying that he would like to address the role that contracts for police federations play in these circumstances. These are the unions that represent police officers. And I don't think you could find a member of Congress, when Ellison was a member of Congress, who was more pro-union than him. And he says aggressively that police union contracts should protect wages, salary, working condition, you know, runs down the whole list. And he's absolutely passionate about maintaining that, maintaining union rights. But where he says you have to make some adjustment and figure something out is in cases where a police federation contract makes it difficult or impossible to get rid of a bad cop. And he very bluntly says that that's, to his view, a real problem in Minneapolis. And it's also a real problem across the country. Exactly. And this is a big deal, because Ellison points out that he has spent a lot of time with police officers. He knows a lot of people who are involved in the criminal justice system. And he says he is powerfully struck by how many of the people he interacts with who are sincere believers in a fairer and better system, who want the change to be made, but who ask the question, if I call out a bad cop, if I report the activities of a police officer who is practicing brutality, will that officer be held to account? And if the officer is not held to account, then what is then if you step forward and call out a fellow officer, instead of getting change, necessary change, you end up in a situation where you, the person who stepped up, is identified as the bad player, right? You're the one who's not trusted by your fellow officers. And so accountability itself, that ability to get rid of a bad cop, makes the whole of a police force better, in Keith Ellison's argument.
So the title of the piece, of John Nichols' piece at the Nation magazine, is entitled Keith Ellison on Police Brutality. We need a vision that says there's going to be accountability. I want to remind everyone, in a lot of ways, John, I'm almost really glad you wrote this before he was appointed to prosecute George Floyd, because it allows this big picture, which is so important. And then you understand that level of trust where they then said, you need to handle this because you do have this big picture. And this won't even be just a one-off in consequence, that this could actually be what I think people are yearning for. Anyway, thank you, gentlemen. We just lost John Nichols, just as I was about to ask him what I think is a very appropriate and parallel question. And that is that when I saw that the Minnesota governor asked the Attorney General, Keith Ellison, to take this case, it reinforced for me something that we had talked about yesterday on The Attitude with our Rethink the Week. And that is that everyone keeps talking about the fact that, well, now it's self-evident that Joe Biden must pick a woman of color to be his VP. What I actually think is more self-evident from what has just happened, and I think Joe Biden needs to sort of talk and grab the moment. And one of the ways I think that Joe Biden could grab the moment, and we talked about this yesterday, and I'm going to say it again today, is that I think he needs to tell us who his attorney general pick would be. And we quoted it yesterday, and I'm going to quote it again today, Ken, and I would have loved to have asked John Nichols what he thought. But Elizabeth Warren says over and over again, personnel is policy. Personnel is policy. His article about Keith Ellison was talking about the kind of policy changes that need to be made. But the policy changes don't have meaning if you don't have the right people in place, because those people are the ones that will affect the policy, that will know where and when to use the policy. And therefore, it is so important. And I think that Joe Biden needs wind in his sails. And everyone says, oh, it'll be just one more thing for people to sort of pick apart. And I said, no, it's one more thing that he says, I get it. I get it. And my attorney general will be able to help me get there. And that's why I have made this choice. So at some point, I'll grab John Nichols again and find out what he thinks about that idea. But I think more than ever, it becomes totally appropriate that we do that.
And just in order to set both sides out, because Dean Spiliotis disagreed with you about this yesterday, there's a difference, I think, between personnel is policy and having good people. I agree with you 100% about that. I'm sure Dean does too. Between that and actually announcing 6 months ahead of the election who you're going to put in place. And that just gives Trump a chance to, every time you've got an important policy point that you want to make, or you're going to have a town hall with the voters, Trump can just dredge up some lies about your
appointees. Let Trump be Trump. Fight your fight. Talk to your base. Have someone who has a record that people can respect, and someone who can actually speak to the issues, because he doesn't have the policy yet. He may never get the policy through. But that kind of personnel tells you what will happen. All right, we need to go to a break. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation on a somewhat depressing note. Coronavirus reminds you of death and amplifies your core values, both bad and good. Oh my God, that I reached out to these two professors last week and we get to talk to them today. How appropriate. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Love is but a song we sing. Fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring, or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing, and you may not know why. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together. Try to love one another, right? Some may come and some may go. He will surely pay his. When the one that left us yet returns for us at last, we are but a moment's sunlight fading in the gray.
Okay, welcome to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. So you know what's one of Arnie's favorite places to go to mine for information and great talkers. I use The Conversation probably more than any radio talk show host in America, and I've actually recommended professors to write for The Conversation. So it works both ways, everyone. And I saw this article, and it resonated with me, maybe because I'm 66 years old and my daughter's about to have a baby, so it'll be my first grandchild. And I've been thinking a lot about life and death. And of course, coronavirus has only amplified that. And the headline spoke to me. Coronavirus reminds you of death and amplifies your core values, both good and bad. Joining us are the co-authors of the piece of The Conversation. Jeff Greenberg is joining us. He is a professor of social psychology at the University of Arizona, and Sheldon Solomon is professor of psychology at Skidmore College. Welcome to the program, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you don't come to this issue because of coronavirus and what the pandemic has sort of exposed. You actually study this, and you have an area of study called terror management. And I thought, whoa, what the heck is that? I know I'm living in terror. I'm not sure I know how to manage the terror. So it's totally appropriate that someone should probably create a field of study about terror management. So Jeff, I'm going to begin with you because it sounds like you're sort of the driver of this. And Sheldon, you have worked with Jeff in the past, even before this article, to work on this issue. So give me a little backstory on this concept, and then explain how we are responding to the pandemic from your understanding of this idea of terror management.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we're equal partners in this, so either of us could speak to these things, certainly. We started with training in social psychology and trying to understand what drives human social behavior. Why are you a radio talk show host? Why do I want to become a professor and all that? We didn't see a lot of answers in the mainstream scientific literature. And we found Ernest Becker, who wrote a book called The Denial of Death, which won the Pulitzer Prize nonfiction. And he argued that our fear of death, our awareness that we're going to die, while at the same time wanting to keep living, creates a potential for terror. For feeling terror, existential terror, that this could all come to an end. It can come to an end anytime. Could be the coronavirus, could be a host of other things, but it's inevitable in any event. And Becker argued that we have to do something with that. We can't just kind of fully face that. And so what cultures try to help us do is feel that we're more than just these creatures that are just fated to oblivion, mm-hmm. that rather we're people with identities that live on in some way. So we might have a sense that we have a soul. Some people believe in an afterlife, but we also feel that we're connected to something that will continue beyond us, and we can make some kind of permanent mark in the world, a lasting mark in the world through the things that we accomplish, through our children, through our values continuing beyond our physical lives. And so what the short version is, what we find in our research is that when things remind us of death, we grab on more tightly to our values, the ways in which we feel transcendent of death, ultimately. So So we want to be better journalists and radio talk show hosts and better professors. Mm-hmm. And we want to assert our values and make sure that they continue. And we want to bolster the things that kind of help us feel that we're more than just creatures.
I'm going to toss to Sheldon, because that sounds all good.
Okay.
Our good values. I want to be a better talk show host. I want to be a better mother. I want to sort of leave something. But Sheldon, you in the headline of the piece, you have that it amplifies your core values, both bad and good. So I'm just trying to figure out why have some of us chosen to amplify what is good about us, and yet others appear to be amplifying what is not necessarily good about them. I mean, that it's almost lethal in nature in some ways. It's almost retaliatory in some ways. Why do some people go to the negative while others go to a more positive place? And as a follow-up to that, is there a way for us to transform that negative feeling into something better? Because in the end, the negative doesn't necessarily produce the kind of results that are better for not only them, but for their community. Sheldon?
Wow. To be silly, if we could answer those questions, we'd be chugging rum out of coconuts on a beach with our Nobel Prize, because that's of critical importance. Let's talk a bit about the downside, and then maybe Jeff can weigh in about how we can distinguish between people that go one way or the others. Our original interest back in the 1970s, when we met as graduate students at the University of Kansas, was to try to understand the psychological underpinnings of prejudice and ethnic conflict. How come people can't get along with other folks who don't share their view of reality? And what Becker said very simply is that if our own beliefs serve to minimize death anxiety, then the mere existence of other people who are different is a problem, whether we're aware of it or not. Because if we accept the validity of an alternative belief system, that undermines the confidence with which we subscribe to our own death-denying beliefs. And according to Becker, what we do, therefore, when we run into people who are different, is we denigrate them and we try to convince or coerce them to dispose of their beliefs and adopt ours instead. And if that doesn't work, then we just kill them, proving that our God is superior after all. And so one thing that we found in our studies is that when we remind people that they're going to die by asking them to just think about themselves dying, or interviewing them in front of a funeral parlor, or blasting the word death for 28 milliseconds on a computer screen so fast that you don't even see it. What we find consistently is that death reminders make people more enthusiastic and supportive of those who share their beliefs, but more hateful and hostile to those who are different. So Christians reminded of their mortality love fellow Christians, and they hate Jewish people. Jewish people reminded of their mortality love Jewish people and hate Muslims and Christians. Germans reminded of their mortality sit further away from people who look Turkish and closer to people who look German. Iranians become more enthusiastic about becoming a suicide bomber. Americans reminded of death become more enthusiastic about the preemptive use of nuclear weapons. And so one of the downsides of death reminders is that it makes us more hostile to people who are different. Another downside is that when we're reminded that we're going to die, it makes us more supportive of a certain kind of political leader. Max Weber called those folks charismatic leaders. Today, we might call them populists, seemingly larger than life individuals who often proclaim that they're divinely ordained to rid the world of evil.
So Trump is the right leader at the right time for people's fear of death.
He is
charismatic. He sort of demands allegiance. He promises everything. And for that base that has embraced whatever the sort of negative values are, Trump is the personification of everything that they kind of want.
That's correct. And as Jeff has noted, when we write about these things together, it's when the prevailing worldview is shaken by economic or environmental uncertainties, that a lot of people, they give up on their culture and glob on to a charismatic, larger-than-life leader. It's what got Hitler elected when he promised to make Germany great in the 1920s. It's what got George W. Bush reelected in 2004 when he said, we will rid the world of evil, and that he believed God had chosen him to do that. It's what got Donald Trump elected in 2016 when he said, I am the only one that can keep you safe. And we've done lots of experiments where we've shown that people who are reminded of their mortality are much more enthusiastic about the Trumps of the world than they would be under benign psychological conditions.
Aren't some people also, when reminded of their own mortality, inclined to realize that all of us are in this together? I mean, we're all mortal, we're all gonna die. And I don't care if you're black or white or Muslim or Jewish or Christian, you know, we're all gonna die. And so we're all in the same Sisyphean position, I guess. And so we should love everybody and sort of cling to each other like you do when you're all out in the wilderness and you're freezing. You hug people, you don't care if they're black or white. It's the same kind of thing, just that survival instinct. Why is that not the motivation? And that kind of a leader could be brought up in this.
But I think you suggest that, Jeff, because at the end of your article, there you do have choices. I mean, it's not the charismatic leader, you have choices, and that there is another form of charismatic leader that can talk about community, that can talk about we're on the same boat, planet Earth, you know,
Obama,
I've got your back, as opposed to I'm going to stab you in the back, Jeff.
Sure, and Obama was that kind of charismatic leader. He was, you know, Clinton before him. Were able to give those kind of speeches that inspired people and gave people hope and gave people a sense that unity might be the better way to go. But that's going to vary from election to election. How it's going to go, who knows? But I wanted to make the point that, you know, one of the implications of all this is that the polarization that we're seeing is intensified when death is close to consciousness, as it is these days.
And it's universal. What's so shocking about this pandemic is that, I mean, you can be in, during the Nazis, you were in a death camp, but all of us weren't in the death camp. Now it's a worldwide death camp. All of us are coming to terms, whether my daughter lives in China. I went through coronavirus 3 months before I went through coronavirus here because I was going through it with her in China. And then it came here. I kept telling her, I'll give you money for a ticket. Come here, you'll be safe. And now I'm thinking, do I have a ticket to go there? Because I might be safer there than I am here. So I think this pandemic is so remarkable because we're all coming to that same experience, and there's no safe place on the planet for you to not sort of face the idea of death. What I'm curious about, and since you've done this and you've exposed people to it before this pandemic, let me give you a little window on me. I moved into this house in Concord, New Hampshire in 2009. And I had not lived in a house with my second husband. We never could afford one, but I ended up inheriting one. But why did I move into this house? Because I had two dying people living in this house. My husband was dying of cancer, and my aunt was dying. She was 93, and she was beginning to lose her mental faculties. So I go from this vibrant political talk show host giving speeches everywhere to basically coming into a home and really not leaving it for almost 5 years in order to sort of deal with the end of life. Both of them died in my arms. They didn't die in a hospital setting, they died here. It changed my relationship with death. I think the other problem, especially for this society, is that we have removed death from our lives. It happens over here. It doesn't happen in your arms. It doesn't happen in your home. And maybe in a lot of ways, we're less prepared because we're so damn sophisticated in the United States to even comprehend or acknowledge the end of life because we've removed it from our living. That somehow that was what society was able to make us do. We send them to a nursing home. We send them to a hospital. We send them to hospice. We don't have them in our arms. And I, therefore, while I fear the pandemic, I am not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of how people are living. That's what I'm fearing, Sheldon. And so what I'm just trying to figure out is, I ask that question, is there a way, and is it that charismatic leader that can take the negative that we see sort of erupting everywhere, especially in the United States, and maybe actually all over the world, in many places we're seeing it, is there a way of guiding that to a better place, to a place that doesn't focus on you're not me, therefore I should not like you, to we're all like each other. We all have red blood. We all have a pulse. We all have a heart. When pandemic hits, it means we all can't breathe. Not just some people, but all of us. So I guess from your terror management, is there a way for us to see some ability to transform that?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, one thing that we know from our research is that people's reaction to death reminders varies as a function of their political orientation. And so folks in the United States who identify as liberal, I always tell the Skidmore students, grab a dictionary. Liberal means it means to be tolerant and open-minded. And sure enough, when we remind liberal participants in one of our studies that they're going to die, they actually like people who are different a lot more. Whereas conservative folks like different people a lot less. Now, this is not an indictment of people as a function of their political preferences. And in fact, there's nothing we can do about it because they are largely inherited. What we can do, as you mentioned earlier, though, is to remind people that as a species, all human beings have more in common than we are different. And our buddy Tom Pazinski, he's done studies with his students where he shows if you tell people, look, we're all part of one big human family, they don't respond to death reminders by hating folks who are different. And so a different kind of leader at this moment would go to extraordinary lengths to remind folks of our basic commonality and profound interdependence. However, it is a fundamental characteristic of populists slash fascists to emphasize the differences between people, the us versus them.
Donald Trump is doing. He's playing that card over and over again. So in a lot of ways, the pandemic is elevating his divide because it's natural instinct, and now he's working the divide.
Yes, he's very good at that. He's not as smart as Hitler, but he's using Hitler's same techniques unselfconsciously and unreflectively. And that is like all good populists. What they are, the alchemists of hate. They take unconscious fears and they transform them into hatred that's projected onto other individuals that we declare the all-encompassing repositories of evil. And the pandemic and the race riots, not to sound all too glib or cynical, but he loves this stuff. This is what got him elected. As Steve Bannon put it in an interview in 2017, it's not ideas that get people to the polls. It's fear and anger. They didn't win in 2016 because of policies, Bannon said. They won because of lock her up, build the wall, and make America great again. And
so let me turn to Jeff. So Jeff, again, I'm thinking about this, and I was a religion major. I was going to be a minister. I was on my way to divinity school, and then whatever happened. And now I am probably more agnostic, if not atheist, in my sort of comprehension. Mm-hmm. But there was one thing that I learned over the course of time, and I grew up in a Jewish Italian neighborhood. And within the Jewish community, I actually went to Hebrew school because all my friends went to Hebrew school and I had nothing to do, so I kind of went with them. But one of the things that I have held on to is that Jews talk about making their heaven here. And my Christian friends talk about heaven on the other side. And I think that there is something very positive about making your heaven here. because it then makes the obligation now. It makes the obligation to care about your fellow man now. It makes you want to care about being a good steward of the environment now, because all the good stuff doesn't happen on the other side. It's got to sort of happen here. And I think in a lot of ways, a leader who can talk about our commonality, who can talk about hope, who can talk about how we can come together to resolve it, in a way is talking about the obligation for us to kind of make our heaven here. And that is an idea of goodness, not an idea of hatred and not an idea of division. It's an idea of finding that Velcro that creates the fabric that holds us together.
Yes, I mean, that would be the ideal kind of leader. And we can certainly hope for that. But people have different conceptions of what heaven would be like here on Earth. And that's one of the ways it gets complicated. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that an incumbent always has an advantage when people are scared, because people are afraid of change, right? I mean, you know, we don't want America completely falling apart. I mean, this is almost as bad as it could get right now. We got riots in the streets. We got this virus still spreading. We don't know what to do about that. So in times of chaos and fear and insecurity, change can scare people. And I think that Biden has to exude a self-confidence and has to be somebody we feel we can put the future of our nation in his hands. So he has to be able to sell that well.
So I need to let you guys go. But what I'm hearing then is that he just can't sit back and like Donald Trump dysfunction and fall apart and exude all this hatred, that he actually has to offer a very different future, but one that people can feel comfort in, can feel secure in, can feel safe in. And it's not enough to watch Donald Trump disassemble, that there is an obligation to offer a different vision. And that is going to be compelling. And because, as you point out, there is an advantage to the incumbent and the fear of change.
So Sheldon, what you're saying before about, it sounded like the last thing you were talking about was similar to what I was saying. And then you turn to Donald Trump as being the archetype of the people who are afraid and turn to hating. But you did sound like you agreed that there are people, there's a way to have a leader who will lead people to their better instincts, even though they are fearful of dying. And I just was wondering, like, what is a strategy that people like us, which I would include myself and probably you in that category, what can we do, or what can we hope that Biden or anybody else will do, so that the Trump message of dividing and hating is defeated in November?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's no way to undermine his message to his base. I like how Eric Hoffer put it in a book, The True Believer, and that's once you're committed to a populist fascist type leader, that puts up a fact-proof screen, in Hoffer's words, between you, the followers, and the world. So the fact that Trump's approval rating has not varied one bit for the most part since he's elected suggests that they will be impervious to rational argument. And so I think the folks that one needs to appeal to are the swing voters. Yeah. I think, yes, Jeff is right. It's incumbent upon Biden to present an image of himself as self-confident but not arrogant. And as Mike Bloomberg put it when at the Democratic National Convention, when his speech in support of Hillary Clinton, he said, sane and competent. And that would be my haiku-like statement in defense of his campaign.
And let me tell you how we convert those Trump people after, let's say Trump loses and Joe Biden. Here's what's going to happen. What will happen is, if all of a sudden they get health care and they don't have to pay for it, and of a sudden they actually see their wages go up, do you think that if they can physically see that their existence has improved, because that's the problem. Since 2008, they lost their shirts. And who got rewarded? The people that took their shirt.
Yeah, I hope so. But I, you know, my view is that this phenomenon has proved that Maslow's hierarchy of needs is actually upside down. It'd be great if you thought about eating first and then self-esteem and all of these higher needs. But what Trump has proven is that it's more important for some of his followers to be white than it is to eat and have health care.
Oh, shit.
I wish we had, keep that on tape. Just before I let you go, so someone just posted this on my Facebook page. It's hilarious. They wrote, "I bet Canada feels like they live in the apartment up of a meth lab."
Well, they do. My Canadian friends feel that way.
That's us. The meth lab. That's the United States. Unbelievable. And on that note, thank you so much, Sheldon, for joining us. I hope this wasn't too painful.
No, it was great. Thank you for having us.
All right, you're welcome. The name of the article at theconversation.com, "Coronavirus Reminds You of Death, Amen, and Amplifies Your Core Values, Both Good and Bad." We've been talking with Jeff Greenberg. He's the University of Arizona Professor of Social Psychology, and Sheldon Solomon, a Professor of Psychology at Skidmore College. Thank you, gentlemen, so much. And I am going to make a recommendation. If you have a loved one that's dying, it's okay for them to die with you at home. I think it changes your relationship with death. And if it does, it makes you stronger, not weaker. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Arnie.
Sure. Thanks so much. Take care.
Ken Barnes, thank you so much as well.
Yes. Bye-bye.